Ministry, In Search of God, the Mother. Right now, Mother Wove the Morning is being performed tonight and Monday in Salt Lake City. For all of you that are interested, it will be 7:30 p.m., Studio 1, 870 East, 71045 South. Tickets are $12 at the door, and also her books and the play are available outside, and all the information is in the lobby. She has also been the author of her own autobiography, Goodbye, I Love You. The recent story of the story of her life with her homosexual husband has been recently purchased by NBC as a television movie to be aired this November. I'm lucky to introduce this fine woman who's been a charismatic and sensitive example of what a Mormon woman can be. And after she finishes, we'll hear comments from Jerry Hurd, the author of Why I Care About My Sisters in the Scriptures, forthcoming in from Aspen Books. So I will say no further. I'm interested to see what the feminism can do, what the feminism could have done for the Nephites.
Thank you so much. Almost every time I have mentioned the title of this address to anyone, could feminism have saved the Nephites? It has brought a laugh. Not a laugh of derision, a laugh of delight. The very idea, mentioning woman power and the Book of Mormon in the same breath. Humor depends on the incongruous, and what could be more incongruous than feminism and the Nephites? Let me propose a very modest definition of feminism, one that has been pointed out to me from the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. Quote, feminism is the philosophical belief that advocates the equality of women and men and seeks to remove inequities and to redress injustices against women. I would now like to trade the word feminism for a word I'd like even better, partnership. There seem to be some who find the word partnership threatening. I find it a beautiful word. To me, partnership is the goal, and feminism is the journey absolutely necessary to get us there. Where? That wonderful land in our gender relationships, choice above all other lands. That space in our minds and our hearts and society where we are truly one. Perhaps we could even call it Zion. My 22-year-old son Aaron is a rock guitarist with a gorgeous blonde hair down the middle of his back and a smile that dazzles. Not long ago he said, "Oh, Mom, I'm writing a new song. I think you'll like it." He reached for his guitar and sang to me, "Behind every good man, there's a woman. Behind every good woman, there's a man. Understand, we're all in this together. It's much easier standing hand in hand." That's as scary as it's going to get in this talk. It's much easier standing hand in hand. Partnership. Last October, I was invited to perform my play, Mother Wove the Morning, on Crete at an international conference to celebrate partnership between women and men. I was sitting in the audience of about 500 people from all over the world, waiting to hear a talk by Margarita Papandreou, former First Lady of Greece, who had invited me. And I was visiting with Hilke, a striking blonde woman from Finland who had represented her country in the United Nations. When I asked the areas of study she was particularly interested in, she said, "I'm doing some writing on the relationship between patriarchy and militarism. Patriarchy cannot survive without militarism, nor militarism without patriarchy." Instantly there flashed into my mind the Nephites, the Lamanites, the dreadful, dreadful warfare that led to their destruction. Ever since high school, I had puzzled over the near unrelenting militarism of that people, and I had mourned over the absence of women in the record and the stunning negative female imagery. But only in the last couple of years had I said to myself There is a connection here. It is not an accident that extreme warfare and extreme bias against women are found in the same society. I believe that the Book of Mormon is indeed a book written for our day, that it contains many powerful lessons that can be of great benefit to us. I propose that there is a lesson in this book that we have not really examined. One that is profoundly important. I propose that a society that negates femaleness will likely be a society that is militaristic, and or that a society that is militaristic will likely be a society that negates femaleness, and that whichever is the cause and whichever the effect, the result may be disastrous. I choose to believe that the anti-female bias I find in the Book of Mormon is not there from malice, but from lack of awareness. I also choose to believe that with awareness comes the desire to do better. Historically, patriarchy and militarism are blood brothers, and the operative word here is blood. Technically, patriarchy is the rule of the fathers. As it translates into experience, it is a view that male is primary and central, and female is secondary and auxiliary, that God is male and there is no complementary female divine. And the result is that the masculine is idealized and worshipped, and the feminine is diminished, marginalized, and abused. So it is not just as an academic exercise that I examine this proposition. We are deeply affected by the way we view the genders. And I believe with all my heart that those really wonderful things the church does to assist us in developing godly self-images and godly relationships are undermined by a distorted view of the sexes that we receive from a variety of quarters. This examination is limited to the Book of Mormon, specifically to the civilization of the Nephites. In the Ensign of June of this year, I found a remarkably insightful statement in an article by Joseph Walker about how Hollywood's images of life conflict with the realities of our own lives. He gives 9 descriptions of the producers that helps to explain this. The first one: most of them are male. There are some incredibly talented men running film studios, producing TV programs, and creating Hollywood magic. But if most of the perspectives we see expressed dramatically are male perspectives, we're only seeing half the story. That explains a lot about the way women are presented, doesn't it? I suggest that also explains a lot about the way women are presented or ignored in our church programs, manuals, talks, scriptures, certainly in the Book of Mormon. Keep in mind that the abridger of this book was not only a prophet, but a military man as well, a fact that unavoidably affected his choices. If General Patton had written an abridgment of Gone with the Wind, we might have lost Scarlet altogether. In my youth, I thought that patriarchy was as firmly fixed as gravity, that nothing else had ever existed. I used to enjoy a brief visit with Hugh Nibley now and then. I had studied Hebrew in Israel, and he found it fun to chat with me in that language as we walked across campus. Later, as I was doing the research for the work that led to Mother Wolf the Morning, I cornered him one day and I said, "Brother Nibley, what about all this stuff I'm reading about a time before the patriarchy?" "Of course," he replied, "the matriarchy. We all know about the matriarchy." "I beg your pardon, Brother Nibley," I said. "We do not all know about the matriarchy." "Well, yes," he said. "There was a time when women were more important, and that had to be balanced by a time when men were more important. But neither of those styles is correct. They're both perversions." In a talk at BYU entitled Patriarchy and Matriarchy, Brother Nibley said the same thing using the word perversions. He said, "There is no patriarchy or matriarchy in the garden. The two supervise each other. Archy means always to be first in order, whether in time or eminence. The point is that there can only be one first. To be first is Satan's first principle." Argument about the existence of a bona fide matriarchy abounds. The evidence seems to indicate that there never was a time that could be described as upside-down patriarchy, where women ruled over men as men have ruled over women in historical time. But a growing body of archaeological evidence indicates, certainly in old Europe, that for thousands of years in the Neolithic, there was a civilization that lasted longer than our war-torn variety, where weapons, fortifications, evidence of violent death, animal or human sacrifice, male dominance, individual wealth, and images of a male sky god simply did not exist, but where there was great honoring of femaleness in mortal woman and in the great goddess of creation. This time came to an end. In the words of Joseph Campbell, eminent mythologist, who described the milder, gentler day of the goddess, this time gave way to, quote, the patriarchal overthrow, a sordid, sorry chronicle of collision, vituperation, coercion, and spilled blood that brought in the order of the patriarchy with an ardor of righteous eloquence and a fury of fire and sword. The arrival of this order has been well documented in numerous other books as well, including Gerda Lerner's The Creation of Patriarchy, Rhianne Eisler's The Chalice and the Blade, and before them Eric Newman's The Great Mother and the work of Robert Graves, in whose The White Goddess he warns that our repressed desire for a divine mother is ignored at our own peril. Militarism, war. Anthropologist Ashley Montague said, "War is exclusively a masculine invention and ghastliness." I was chilled to read recently that Edward Teller, who was hailed as the father of the H-bomb, announced the success of its first test with the words, "It's a boy." A reviewer of a landmark book by a top archaeologist, Maria Gimbutas, writes that Gimbutas' work in unearthing pre-patriarchal societies is giving the dream of peace substance. Quote, "To people who claim that war and violence are hardwired into the human mainframe, she is proving that war is just a floppy disk. Our persistent images of paradise lost, the golden age, Eden, are actual collective memories. I do not suggest that all men are warlike and all women are peaceable. It is possible and has happened for women to be warriors and to lead armies, and many men give their all to proclaiming and living peace. But current research shows that there does seem to be a particular tendency in the female brain and or female socialization that encourages women and girls rather consistently to choose cooperation over competition." Simon LeVay, a neurobiologist whose recent book, The Sexual Brain, explores the differences between male and female brains, says that, not surprisingly, men seemed more programmed to be more aggressive than women. I am reminded of Alan Alda's assessment that our society suffers from testosterone poisoning. At any rate, it is not hard to guess in what direction society moves when runaway masculinity is untempered by a balancing femininity. I propose that we find a remarkable example within the pages of the Book of Mormon. Let us examine these two phenomena: militarism in the Book of Mormon and the accompanying bias against and negative portrayal of women. We will spend very little time on the first because it is so obvious. According to the book Warfare in the Book of Mormon, published by Deseret Book, there are approximately 100 separate instances of armed conflict in the record. And Hugh Nibley estimates that the book devotes approximately one-third of its content, directly or indirectly, to military matters. Scenes of bloodshed and almost unbelievable violence stain the pages of the book, featuring both the bad guys and the good guys. In one battle, the Nephites slaying 12,532 Amalekites, and the Amalekites slaying 6,562 Nephites. Nephi cutting off the head of Laban, Ammon cutting off the arms of the enemies of King Lamoni. Scenes of terrible violence in the book are unforgettable. Evidently less obvious to some, though never to me, is the parallel absence of and negative portrayal of women in the Book of Mormon. A few years ago, I read the book specifically to focus on what it says about women. I circled in red every female reference. And as I did, it became more and more clear to me why I had always felt like an unwelcome visitor as I entered Nephite society. A stranger in a strange land indeed. The valuable things I have gleaned from the Book of Mormon have been bought at the expense of putting my femaleness aside and ignoring what is said of it. And while I am more than my femaleness is a profound and highly valued part of me. And to have to put it away while I travel through the book does enormous violence to my spirit. When I encounter the occasional statement that would appear inviting to women, I stare at it as at an anachronism. Quote, "He inviteth all to come unto him and partake of his goodness, and he denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female, and all are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile." And now he imparteth his word by angels unto men, yea, not only men, but women also. Where are the stories to demonstrate this expansive doctrine? At least in the account that we have been given, there is a huge division between male and female, a clear devaluing of the female, and angels do not visit women. Do we have here a preachment without a practice? Was there something going on that did not make its way into the record? All we know for sure is what appears in the pages of the book, and what appears there is not inviting to women or admiring of femaleness. In only two instances in the entire 522 pages did I find evidence that women are being specifically addressed along with men. In 2 Nephi chapter 4, we find that Lehi speaks to and blesses both the sons and the daughters of his sons, Laman and Lemuel. "Behold, my sons and my daughters, I would that ye should give ear unto my words." That is the first and nearly the last time in the book that I, as a woman, feel specifically invited to the party. Thereafter, I have to invite myself. Until the very end of the book where I read, "O ye fair sons and daughters, ye fathers and mothers, ye husbands and wives, ye fair ones, how is it that ye could have fallen?" Sometimes the exclusion of women seems particularly surprising. For instance, during King Benjamin's beautiful address in Mosiah 2, women are obviously physically present. Quote, "They pitched their tents round about, every man according to his family, consisting of his wife and his sons and his daughters and their sons and their daughters." And King Benjamin speaks from his tower, "My brethren, all ye that have assembled yourselves together. And now I say unto you, my brethren." And again, "My brethren. O all ye old men, and also ye young men, and you little children who can understand my words." In one instance, there is an indication that the listeners shall become the sons and daughters of Christ. But every salutation is only to "my brethren." This is the case throughout the book. King Mosiah sends a written word to the people. "Behold, O ye my people," or "my brethren, for I esteem you as such." We have come to assume that most of the good teachings of the book apply to women as well as to men, and yet there is room for some of us to quip. Men are that they might have joy, and women are that they might provide it. Nowhere in the book do we find the phrase, my brethren and my sisters, or anything comparable to it. I am an outsider, overhearing something important that is going on in another room. Arise, my sons, and be men. Awake, my sons. Did the Nephite women feel similarly ignored? Certainly, if only on a subconscious level. The general overhaul of school textbooks in the last couple of decades brought with it substantial evidence of what happens to the self-image of girls and other groups when they are excluded from the teaching material. And psychologists tell us that for one's mental health, being ignored is worse than being beaten. However, if women are not spoken to in the Book of Mormon, they are spoken of occasionally. Except for references to the biblical women Eve, Mary, and Sarah, there are three women mentioned by name in the Book of Mormon: Sariah, wife of Lehi, Abish, the Lamanitish woman involved in the story of Ammon and King Lamoni, and Isabel, the harlot. This is in stark contrast to the presence of women in the Bible. 188 women are mentioned by name in the Bible, compared to 3 in the Book of Mormon. Indeed, 2 books of the Bible are named after women, Esther and Ruth. In the Old Testament, he and his appear 6.5 times more often than she and her. But in the Book of Mormon, the masculine pronouns appear on average 35 times more often than the feminine ones. And in the abridgment after the small plates, 46 times more often. And many of the she's and hers refer not to people, but to objects, many of them negative, which we will consider in a moment. Numerous biblical women can serve as spiritual role models for women today. Huldah was a prophetess. Deborah was a prophetess. Miriam was a prophetess. There is not one woman in the Book of Mormon that appears to have her own connection to the heavens. Sariah does not receive anything like the visionary experience that Lehi has. Nephi is given the vision of the tree of life after his father receives it, but Sariah is not. Abish, who does perform one of the few strong deeds done by a woman in the book, was converted to the Lord because of a remarkable vision her father had had years before, not a vision of her own. Lamoni's queen is another spiritually dependent woman. She does not receive from God the knowledge that Ammon is a prophet, but from her husband's servants. And she says to Ammon, who asks if she believes, I have had no witness save thy word. Nevertheless, I believe. When I think of that nameless queen of King Lamoni, I always remember the very vivid lesson given by my seminary teacher at BOI High School in Provo. When her husband, the king, has lain upon his bed for the space of 2 days and 2 nights, and some said he was dead and stinketh and ought to be placed in a sepulcher, she says, as for myself, he doth not stink. My teacher chose this as a wonderful example of good wifehood and instructed all the girls in the class that for a happy marriage, no matter what the husband does or what anyone else says about him, our position must be firm. To me, he stinketh not. I venture to guess that the only story most of us have heard used in a talk about women in the Book of Mormon is the story of the mothers of the stripling warriors who instilled faith in their sons. Predictably, the huge majority of references to women are to the nameless, faceless, our women or our wives clearly listed with the Nephite men's possessions. And now may the peace of God rest upon you and upon your houses and lands and upon your flocks and herds and all that you possess, your women and your children. Our women did bear children in the wilderness. Our women did give plenty of suck for their children. I, Nephi, do take my family, and also Zoram and his family, and Sam, mine elder brother, and his family, and Jacob and Joseph, my younger brethren, and also my sisters. What? Nephi had sisters? Finally, after reaching the promised land and telling numerous stories about his brothers, Nephi mentions that he has sisters. They are not spoken of before nor after. And I did cause that the women should spin and toil and work all manner of fine linen, yea, and cloth of every kind, that we might clothe our nakedness. And now the design of the Nephites was to support their lands and their houses, their wives and their children. And it came to pass that he rent his coat, and he took a piece thereof and wrote upon it, in memory of our God, our religion and freedom and our peace, our wives and our children. Behold, their women did toil and spin and did make all manner of cloth of fine twined linen and cloth of every kind to clothe their nakedness. The strong anti-female statement that is made by Nephite society, however, comes not only from the lack of inclusion of meaningful stories about individual women in the Book of Mormon, but also from female imagery applied to things rather than people. Numerous objects are rendered female, some of them neutral in value, some of them with a positive connotation. We read, "One other ship also did sail forth, and whither she did go, we know not. I have gathered in the natural branches again into their mother tree. For they will not seek wisdom, neither do they desire that she shall rule over them. And all the nations that fight against Zion and that distress her shall be as a dream of a night vision. However, as I created my list of feminine imagery, I was distressed to see how many were negative symbols. And I beheld that their mother Gentiles were gathered together upon the water and upon the land also to battle against them. Yea, woe unto this great city of Zarahemla because of the wickedness and abominations which are in her. Touch not that which is unclean, go ye out of the midst of her." Of course, the mother of all negative female images in the Book of Mormon is, have you guessed, the great and abominable church, the mother of abominations, the mother of harlots, the whore of all the earth. I wonder if we appreciate what this really means. The males who lived in Book of Mormon times and the males who read the book today have as major symbols for their maleness God the Father, Jesus Christ, the Holy Ghost, and all the prophets. And the females who lived in Book of Mormon times and the females who read the book today have as a major symbol for their femaleness the great and abominable church, the whore of all the earth. In a chiasm in 1 Nephi chapter 22, we find the great whore paired directly against her opposite, the Holy One of Israel. There is no mistaking the gender of ultimate good and the gender of ultimate evil. Joseph Campbell, in his important book, The Power of Myth, reminds us that the word abomination is the Old Testament word for the Canaanite goddess. And the Canaanite goddess and the other pre-patriarchal goddesses were historical descendants of the ancient mother goddess, worshipped by many names in nearly every known part of the prehistoric world. I find this to be astonishing irony. The genealogy of the great and abominable church can be traced in a convoluted, upside-down and inside-out journey to the best vision our primitive family had of our Divine Mother. The material in the Book of Mormon quoted from Isaiah gives further negative female imagery. Without having to turn a page, I find six separate images that are not complementary to my femaleness. Children are their oppressors and women rule over them. Because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. And her gates shall lament and mourn, and she shall be desolate and shall sit upon the ground. And in that day seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. Therefore, hell hath enlarged herself and opened her mouth without measure. And in the middle of these six negative female images we find, and then will I sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved, touching his vineyard. My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. He, my well-beloved, she, hell, and the filthy daughters of Zion. So much for Isaiah as a friend to the female. Surely I would do much better with the words of Jesus. Let us see. In 3 Nephi, there is an acknowledgement of the slain of the fair sons and daughters of my people. And there is the biblical image of how oft would I have gathered you as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings. But there ends the inclusion of women or positive statements about women. Instead, we find speech directed only to males. And as many as have received me, to them have I given to become the sons of God. Whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her, whosoever shall put away his wife. Pray in your families unto the Father, always in my name, that your wives and your children may be blessed. Depart ye, go ye out from thence. Touch not that which is unclean. Go ye out of the midst of her. Go ye out of the midst of her. In the words of Jesus, my heart dropped. And then I said to myself, wait a minute, this does not sound like the same Jesus that spoke to me in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I long rejoiced in the fact that Jesus was a clear revolutionary in his treatment of women. And as I owned a red letter edition of the Bible, I could easily examine his words. Did Jesus ever, ever make a statement in the New Testament that used negative female imagery? I searched through every word. None. Not one. Indeed, on an occasion where he might have chosen a negative image that was female, Jesus chose a male one, the father of lies. To contrast the heavenly father with the father of lies is not necessarily a statement on gender. But to contrast the heavenly father with the mother of abominations is very much a statement on gender. What a delicious experience is reading the words of Jesus in the New Testament after reading the Book of Mormon account. There Jesus does address women. Daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith hath made thee whole. Frequently, Jesus chooses a male and a female example and pairs them with each other in a way that is clearly deliberate. The men of Nineveh shall rise up in judgment with this generation, paired with the queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation. The kingdom of heaven is like to a grain of mustard seed which a man took, paired with the kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven which a woman took. Then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left, paired with two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. These pairings are not accidental. Images of women in the words and the life of Jesus are not hard to remember. His mother receiving a vision from an angel who had asked permission of no man. His relationship with Martha and Mary, the virgins with their lamps, the woman at the well, the woman with the ointment, the woman with the issue of blood, the woman of Canaan whose daughter was healed, the sinner he would not condemn, the daughter of the ruler of the synagogue who was healed, the widow who gave her mite. Woman, first to hear of his mission and first to witness his resurrection. Even Paul singles out women by name in his letters and gives them titles comparable to his own. With the richness of these stories in mind, I have found it difficult to understand how the same Jesus who gave us these wonderful female images in the New Testament, when with the Nephites, would not speak to women or significantly of women, and indeed chose to say, "Touch not that which is unclean, go ye out of the midst of her." The Old Testament ancestors of the Nephites, while surely not a partnership society and guilty of many abuses toward women, nevertheless had a rich tradition that included women. The New Testament contemporaries of the Nephites, in spite of certain statements that demean the position of women, had a rich tradition that included women. The descendants of the Nephites and those other people who lived later on the American continent have in their literature many positive and powerful references to women and to the concept of the feminine. In the Popol Vuh of the Mayans we read, "The creator and the maker, the mother and the father of life, of all created things, he who gives breath and thought, she who gives birth to all the children." And in the histories of many Native American tribes, we find evidence of women owning all the property, ruling as queens, controlling agricultural production, and inheriting from mother to daughter, traditions that ended with the coming of the white man. What does all this mean? What indeed was Mormon's role in shaping the account? Is this anti-female slant a mirror both of the society and of the historian? Or is this view of women precisely what God intended? And therefore I should cease my questioning. In any event, the low status of women and negative in Nephite culture was predictably coupled with abuse of women. To be sure, Nephite men suffered enormously. Being sent off to kill and be killed is a terrible fate. But it is a general rule that in every culture, women receive an additional level of abuse because of their gender. Various parts of the Nephite record refer to women being beaten, having their tender hearts broken because of the faithlessness of their polygamous husbands, being stolen as wives, being required to defend those who stole them, being taken prisoners, being offered as sacrifices, being burnt to death, being raped, being tortured to death, and then having their flesh devoured by men, and being fed on the flesh of their husbands with only a little water. I found interesting the discussion my Sunday school class had about a year ago regarding the story of Alma and Amulek being forced to watch the women and children of Ammoniah being thrown into the fire and consumed. What a painful thing, the teacher lamented, it must have been for them to stand and watch this terrible scene. Well, I ask, what about the pains of the women and children who were being burned? We are assured, of course, that it's all right because the Lord receives them to himself in glory. But I notice that we're all very happy when Alma and Amulek get away unharmed. We don't want them to be received unto the Lord in glory. Women, of course, have a long and honorable tradition of being devoured by the flames. Men are burned in the Book of Mormon and throughout history, but nowhere near in the numbers that women are. Probably 85% of witches burned in the Inquisition were female. Besides contributing to the obvious abuses of women in the narrative, I am suggesting that the anti-female bias evident among the Nephites may have been one of the numerous causes of their downfall, for all the reasons presented in the first part of this discussion. We are told that after the visit of Christ, there were approximately 200 years of peace, where the people were as one. Who knows what softening of hierarchical status there was then in terms of class, race, gender. The only explanation of the end of that idyllic period is that they began to be lifted up in pride, such as the wearing of costly apparel, and no longer had their goods in common among them. They began to be divided into classes. One can only speculate about those divisions. None of the prophets in the Book of Mormon suggest that the low status of and negative portrayal of women is a characteristic of their fallen society. But they do suggest that their imperfections were many. The final prophet, Mormon, wrote, "Give thanks unto God that he hath made manifest unto you our imperfections, that ye may learn to be more wise than we have been." That ye may learn to be more wise than we have been. I have been taught all my life that the Book of Mormon gives us voices from the dust, preserved that we may learn the lessons of this fallen people. Let me state again. A society that marginalizes its women and creates negative images of femaleness is a society that will not succeed. Indeed, a society that may very well destroy itself. Have we any examples closer to our own day that pair militarism and the low status of women? What about Saddam Hussein's Iraq, hungry for conquest, their women hidden behind veils, and their leader using such imagery as the mother of all battles? What about Nazi Germany, called by the name the Fatherland, in which the women were sent back to the kitchen, and of which Hitler said, "The Nazi revolution will be an entirely male event"? A government, a movement, a view of history, a church, a marriage, a philosophy that is an entirely male event will not succeed. In a way, it is useless to ask the question, could feminism have saved the Nephites, though it is so intriguing to me? What if the Nephite women and the Lamanite women, like the great women of Aristophanes' Lysistrata, had said to their warriors, "I'm sorry, I will not share your bed until you find a better way than all this warring nonsense"? What if a woman had walked from her tent to the foot of the tower and said, "King Benjamin, I'm here too. Speak to me." Or approached King Mosiah or any of the other prophets and said, "Wait, what about me? What about the women?" What if a committee of women from the Zarahemla Toiling and Spinning Society had approached the leadership and said, "Dear brethren, we are weary of toiling and spinning and making all manner of cloth and watching you kill each other. We wish to weave the fabric of a new society. We would like to sit in your councils and help figure out a way to save the world for our children's children." What if a few Nephite women had stood up in their Sunday school class and said, "Brethren, I object to my femaleness being rendered in terms of the great and abominable church. Brethren, you tell me of the Father and the Son. Brethren, where is my mother?" And what if some young Nephite rebel with long hair, or more probably with short hair, had picked up his guitar or his zither and sung, "Understand, we're all in this together. It's much easier standing hand in hand"? What if one or more of the Nephite prophets had said to himself, "There's something wrong with this picture. We are seeing things only through one eye. Why don't we open the other eye? Why don't we invite the women to participate in our decision making, in our political life, and in our spiritual life? Perhaps they have something to contribute more important than all manner of fine cloth. What if? But whatever female voices or sympathetic male voices may have ever spoken, they are long, long lost to the dust. And what they said, or wish they could have said, or might have said, had they had the awareness and the power, we will never know. We have the awareness, and we have the power. Our voices are not yet lost to the dust. We can speak, and we must. It is time to say, on behalf of our Nephite sisters and brothers, on behalf of ourselves and our posterity, let us learn to be more wise than they have been. I am suggesting three things as ways to be more wise. Firstly, I am suggesting that we teach the Book of Mormon in an expanded context, that we teach these stories with an acknowledgement of what they say about women and a clear message that what they say is not the message God wants us to have. And in fact, that the Nephite view of women may have been one of the many things that led to their downfall. In the hundreds of talks and lessons on the Book of Mormon I have listened to in sacrament meeting, relief society, primary, seminary, firesides, stake, and general conference, from men and women alike, I have never once heard the Book of Mormon approached with a sensitivity to what it says about my femaleness. Occasionally there has been a jest about the lack of women in the book, but never has there been a serious acknowledgement of what this means to me and to all of us. And because what it means is profoundly important, we cannot afford to ignore it. The messages that go into our spirits and our psyches as we study this book and absorb the positive images of the male and the absent or negative images of the female affect our lives, our self-image, our image of the opposite sex, our relationship to God, and our relationships to one another. Secondly, and I argue with myself about this because in a way it might muddy the clarity of one reason this was indeed a fallen people, but I suggest we examine it. It may be possible to correct some of the problem. For example, the great and abominable church, the mother of harlots, the whore of all the earth, this entity does not need to be female. The church has a history of responding to demonstrated need and to voiced offense. The great and abominable church used to be characterized as the Catholic Church. The additions of McConkie's Mormon doctrine show the change from that because we do not wish to offend the Catholics. The statement, white and delightsome, in the Book of Mormon has been changed to pure and delightsome, clearly done because we do not want to offend people of color. The statement in our hymnal, long shall the blood that was shed by assassins stain Illinois, has been changed to plead unto heaven because we do not want to offend the people of the state of Illinois. I was interested in the April Ensign report on the recent and highly successful tour of the Tabernacle Choir to Israel. Gerald Otley is quoted as saying, "We had to be sensitive to singing for a non-Christian audience. For instance, when we sang, 'God be with you till we meet again,' we could sing the word God because that is not necessarily a reference to Christ. But in the chorus, instead of singing, "Till we meet at Jesus' feet," we sang, "Till we meet at our Redeemer's feet." We had to go through every lyric and make those kinds of adjustments. I am happy that we do not wish to offend the Jewish people. But how happy I will be when finally we make some adjustment in our language, because we do not want to offend women. Hear, hear. Perhaps the situation is just too close to us. I see it really as similar to my narrative poem, The Steward, in which the conscientious farmer Heber cultivates his lands and completely fails to cultivate the spirit, the talents, the needs of his wife. I believe that we have devoted our energy to seeing that our language does not offend the people of the world, and have given no thought to how it may affect the women working so devotedly in our own home. And when we see the suffering this has caused, spiritually, psychologically, physically, our lamenting will be great. The third thing I am suggesting is, whatever we do about the past, making alterations or changing the context, we realize that the present is the point of greatest power. That now, this moment, we create new and powerful images of women and femaleness. That we create new volumes of history, and indeed new scripture, that will fill our minds and our hearts with positive female pictures. That we let the mother of abominations die a final death, and in her place, welcome back to the family our long lost and near forgotten divine mother. Perhaps it does take someone to say it out loud. Clearly a Catholic spoke up. Clearly a person of color spoke up. Clearly an Illinoisan and a Jewish person spoke up. Today I am speaking up. And I am saying that I deserve better. The magnificent Mormon women and girls that I know and love deserve better. The church that I grew up in and that I love and that my grandmother Sarah walked across the plains for deserves better. Let the women speak up and say, "This is not good enough for me." Let the men speak up and say, "This is not good enough for my daughters, for my wife, for my mother, for my sisters, for me as a man, because what damages the female damages all of us, and it's much easier standing hand in hand." I believe there are huge numbers of men who are ready to say this. The men that I associate with personally, in my ward, in my stake, in my family, and as I come and go in various parts of Mormondom, are good men, enlightened men, teachable men. I have full confidence that we are ready to move forward together. And as we move forward, the healing benefits will be felt in every ward, in every home, in every heart. Patriarchy can transform into partnership, hastening our journey to Zion. And in that happy land, the beautiful daughters of Zion will dance. And the beautiful sons of Zion will dance. And we will sing together a new song. And great will be the joy of it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I too was very moved by Carolyn's paper and her presentation today. So my comments are going to be very short so that you can have time to question her and add your comments to this session. Reading this paper brought to mind a bit of graffiti that I saw inside a woman's bathroom at the University of Colorado. Scribbled large and appropriately in red lipstick, it said, "War is Menzies' envy." I debated whether it was appropriate to bring that up in this context, not because I didn't think it was kind of clever, but because Carolyn never says anything that crude, and I think that that is one of the strengths of her paper. Now, don't get me wrong. I think this paper is direct, hard-hitting, and raises some difficult questions. But I appreciate the fact that partnership is mentioned or brought up very strongly in the second paragraph. Let's be honest. Anger is the appropriate response to uncovering the perversions that patriarchy and militarism create in a society, whether that society is the Nephite society or our own. But anger is not the way to affect change. The strength of this paper is that Carolyn not only uncovers the old problem, patriarchy, but she offers the only plausible answer, which is partnership. We cannot create a Zion society where we are engaged in accusations that divide us. That way lies contention. On the other hand, simply ignoring contention by ignoring inequities or trying to smooth things over is not the answer either. That way lies canker, the growing pain that will infect all of us eventually. I consider myself a feminist, but I am not angry at men. At the moment, I am the lone female in a household of men. A husband, sons. I looked around one day and realized that even the pets in our house are of the male gender. That's fine. In fact, that's better than fine. That's wonderful. I enjoy these men a great deal. I want only the best for them as they wish for me. None of us is ever enriched by the degradation of another. We are all either richer together or we are poorer together. That is what the oneness of Zion means. And that is a principle so fundamental that it operates consistently even when we are far, far from being a Zion society. In other words, a society that devalues any member cannot rise above the level of that member. We approach Zion hand in hand, or we don't approach at all. That's not the way it should be. That is the way it works. So, could feminism have saved the Nephites? Absolutely. Can feminism save us? I hope so. Carolyn says that the mere mention of the title of her address was enough to bring on a laugh, and I will admit to chuckling the first time I heard it. It was a laugh of recognition. Noting the lack of women in the Book of Mormon is hardly new. Others have pointed that out. I've written about it myself. But I have sort of shrugged it off. Mormon tells us that in making his abridgment, he could not include even 1/100th of the material that he had. So I assumed that information about women just somehow didn't get to the top 1/100th, at least not in Mormon's opinion. But Carolyn takes it a step further. She sees in that lack as something that is symptomatic of a larger problem in the Nephite culture, and to me that is enlightening. I will probably never read about the Nephites and their endless warfare in quite the same way, thanks to Carolyn's paper. And yet I imagine that some might object, pointing out that the record we have of the ancient Nephites is so limited that it is highly speculative to try and draw broad conclusions as to the treatment of women from it. That same criticism has been leveled at the notion that long ago before history there were matriarchies, but I don't think those objections will stand up. In the case of ancient matriarchies, there is mounting archaeological evidence. And when it comes to the Nephites, we don't need to know every detail of their day-to-day lives to recognize a pattern. The Nephites were clearly a militaristic society, and there is ample evidence that all militaristic societies devalue women in exactly the way Carolyn describes. Well, that is a long explanation for my short laugh of recognition. Of course, I thought, why didn't I see that before? It's really quite plain. But I think Carolyn's paper raises a potentially even more troublesome issue. Do the scriptures reflect the mind and will of God, or the peculiar cultural biases of the particular writers? Let me state that another way. Was it God's will that women be left out of the Book of Mormon, or was that Mormon's choice? I offer two examples drawn from Scripture that I think illuminate this particular point. The first one comes from the Book of Mormon. It comes from 3 Nephi chapter 23, verses 7 through 13. Jesus is among the Nephites, and he has asked them to bring their records to him. He examines their records, and then he says to them, "I commanded my servant Samuel the Lamanite that he should testify unto this people. Was it not so?" And the disciples answered, saying, "Yea, Lord, Samuel did prophesy according to thy words, and they were all fulfilled." Then Jesus asked, "How be it that ye have not written this thing?" And the text goes on to explain that the account of Samuel the Lamanite and his prophecies were then added to the records that the Nephites had at Jesus' specific command. Now I have to ask, was there also a racial bias such that the prophecies of a Lamanite were not included in the record until specifically commanded that they should be put there? Whatever the reason, it was clearly not the Lord's mind and will that Samuel be left out. My second example is drawn from the Old Testament, the book of Numbers, the 27th chapter. Moses and the priest Eleazar are numbering the men who are over 20 years of age, and then they are dividing up the land, giving them inheritances in the promised land. In the midst of that process, the five daughters of Zelophehad come before Moses and plead their cause. Their father had died in the wilderness and left no sons, but they ask, why should his family have no inheritance because he had no sons? Standing in public before a congregation that is described as the princes, before the door of the tabernacle, these five women, named Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah, ask Moses to give them their father's inheritance. What does Moses do? Well, the scriptures say that Moses brought their cause before the Lord. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad speak right. Thou shalt surely give them a possession of an inheritance among their father's brethren. That's pretty clear. And there are no qualifications. The will of the Lord was for the five daughters of Zelophehad to have their father's inheritance. But what happens when Moses goes to implement that particular directive? In chapter 36 of Numbers, we find emissaries from the families of Gilead, Manasseh, and Joseph coming to Moses in private and complaining about this matter. They say that if the daughters of Zelophehad inherited their father's land and then married outside of their father's tribe, then that tribe would lose control over that land. And that could not be tolerated. Therefore, the law was modified. The daughters of Zelophehad could inherit, but only so long as they agreed to marry within their father's tribe. Was that modification the mind and will of the Lord or a political expediency? This is a troublesome issue because I'm mindful of those who want the comfort of believing that Scripture, at least, can be trusted. If you believe, as Joseph Smith reportedly stated, that the Book of Mormon is, quote, the most perfect book, unquote, then God must have wanted it exactly the way it is. I recognize this as a heartfelt desire to have something sure to cling to, and there is little enough of that in this world. On the other hand, my concept of God is violated by any notion that he would or could ignore his daughters. I must look for another explanation. In that search, I find Carolyn's paper both plausible and comforting. One more point. Feminism itself. More than a few find the very idea of feminism threatening. To some, the notion that feminism might have saved the Nephites is borders on heresy. And I am sure that many of you in this audience are well aware of the fact that one of the brethren has recently described feminism as, quote, an enemy of the church, unquote. But really now, what's more scary? Cruise missiles, nuclear warheads, B-1 bombers, assault rifles, or a few women standing up like Zelophehad's daughters to ask for their rightful inheritance? It is my great, great pleasure to have been able to stand up today with Carolyn Pearson, and now I give you time to stand up with your comments.
Am I rightfully assuming that this is for comments?
Sure.
I would just like to say that I am deeply grateful to Carolyn for a lot of things, but most especially at this point in my life for the play, Motherwell of the Morning. I have been in the happy position of having had my teenage sons see the play a number of times, as well as my husband. And I couldn't be more grateful. As my goal as a mother is to raise my sons to be good men, and that has helped more than anything else, especially when they deal with the sexism in junior high and high school, etc. So I'm advocating that all of you bribe, coerce, drag, whatever your husbands, your fathers, and your sons to see the play. I can't think of a more important work to be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Sydney. wasn't made clear. Is this on? Was it made clear, for those of you who might be able to drag somebody, that I made a video of the play, which is out there on a table, along with the printed text.
I want to thank Carolyn Pearson for making a very persuasive case for women. It's indeed very, very persuasive. But one thing that I was most delighted to hear was that the authorities did actually change the words of one text from Jesus' feet to Redeemer's feet. I'm an educator. I'm a college professor. And I've been deeply worried about the prayer issue. I have been in Utah for the last 24 years this December. I came in December 69. And in the days before prayers were suspect, they were offered many, many times in public, even on campus. But in the last 24 years of my stay in Utah, only 3 times have I heard prayers said generically in the name of God or the Great Spirit or the Redeemer. And you talked about the psychological damage that ignoring and leaving out does to us women. And I think all of us recognize that. I would like you to also think about the psychological damage that a classroom prayer uttered and said daily, day after day, every 5 days of the week, in grade schools, prayers said only in the name of Jesus Christ might do to damage the spiritual life of Jewish, Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, Vietnamese, Taoist, all kinds of other religions represented in that classroom. And these little children have no voice. They have not cultivated their voice as some of us women have. And I think if the text, if the words of one text were changed from Jesus' feet to Redeemer's feet, we can also say, and this we say in the name of our Redeemer, or this we say in God's name. We don't have to say this we say in Jesus' name, but my Mormon friends have told me that a prayer does not reach unless said in the name of Jesus. And then how do we reconcile classroom prayers and promote all religions? Our nation was built on the idea of this freedom. I hope you would make a plug for that, because this needs to be done.
Thank you.
We cannot cripple the spiritual lives of our children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carolyn, thank you very much. And Jerry, I appreciated your response as well. I support unequivocally your suggestions that we expunge the pejorative references to gender in the things that we do and say in the Mormon Church and society in general. But I would like to add one more perspective, Carolyn, to what you said. And this isn't to say that to negate anything you've said, it's to add to it. Sometimes your title here, Could Feminism Have Saved the Nephites? And I think we all agree, probably. And I would add to that question, can the Nephites' lack of feminism save us? And I think that there is a possibility in that if we bring a new perspective to the way we read the Book of Mormon and the Nephite story. If instead of reading it as an instruction manual, we read it as a cautionary tale. And instead of necessarily going back and changing the language in there to be gender neutral, we look at what happened to that society because of the way that they treated women. I think sometimes the ellipses in a story speak as loud as the words that are on the printed page. And if we as Mormons approach the story of the Nephites in a new perspective and say, this society failed because of how they treated women, and here are examples, and we give them those examples of pejorative language, we'll see it in a new framework without changing it. And in some ways, it carries a lot more impact. But it will take all of us to help put it in a new framework as we study it.
Yes, thank you.
I am only aware of one scriptural reference that binds us to the custom of referencing Jesus in the conclusion of all prayers and speeches. And that is the reference, all that thou doest, do in the name of the Son. That is such a spiritually referenced instruction. It has no direct connection to talks and to prayers. More like the utterances of Amulek about crying unto God for everything. And I think we have a very, very clean window to enter the dialogue with the point that's been made about how we address, and I think this is a good time to do it.
Thank you.
I have noted that the Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price are equally exclusive of women, and that the language that we find therein and also in most conference addresses, even contemporary ones, tend to be gender exclusive. When I worked on the easy-to-read Book of Mormon, my feeling was that I wanted my daughters to feel included as they read the Book of Mormon because I personally had felt so excluded. And so the balancing act of portraying the patriarchy and the effects of the anti-femaleness on the Nephites was kind of juxtaposed with this desire that my children and other female readers of the Book of Mormon would be able to better internalize the message, the overall messages of God to them. And this was a real struggle to me, and I still struggle with this as I reflect upon the work that I've done. I guess I would want to plead for the brethren of our day to take much greater pains with their language. I cringe every time I'm not included, and that other women are not included in conference addresses. There are too many literalists out there who are all too ready to pounce on male language to show that women ought not to be engaged in certain kinds of things. Our language has been used against women historically, and it grieves me to see it continuing to be used in this manner. Thanks a lot for your presentation, though, Carolyn.
Thank you.
I've got two comments. One is for you, Jerry, and that is when you said, did Moroni choose not to include women? I think there's only a choice when there's an awareness of alternatives. And so I think in a culture, and my own experience in the Middle East and that culture, there's not a choice if you've been raised in a certain way unless you have that awareness. And so I thank you, Carolyn, for giving us the awareness through your play and things like that. And I wanted to share a personal experience very briefly with it. When I had an opportunity to have a discussion with one of the leaders in the Relief Society presidency, and she commented directly to me her feelings about the Book of Mormon. And her words were that the Book of Mormon was written by men, about men, for men, and that she looked forward to the day when our scriptures included women's stories and men's stories that we can all relate to, and finding the feminine and the masculine in each of us. And that has given me comfort over the last year in hearing her words and knowing that she may not be comfortable in sharing those feelings all the time, but that at least that she has some of those feelings.
Thank you.
Yes, Carolyn, there are men out there who care about you. And I don't know how many of us there are, and I don't know what they all do. All I have done is that for several years now I have refused to accept any calling in the church to which my wife is not, cannot also be called.
Great. Thank you. Wonderful.
My question is to both of you. I deeply agree with what you say, your suggestions, but how can we pull this off when we're told constantly to not come to places like this because here are the dissenters and the apostates? How can we bring people to listen to this in a logical way that does not frighten them away, and that how can we combat the current influences and charges of the brethren that we should all be facing the same way, and that we should all not let the threat of intellectuals and feminism come into this church?
Well, I guess we just, well, we're told when bad thoughts come to us, we sing a hymn.
I go through my kitchen singing, "Do what is right, let the consequence follow." No, what your question is very profound. And if anybody here has a really good answer, boy, you can get up here now and give it. Well, what is the answer? I mean, each one of us. Pardon me? I do believe that if more of us just stop saying, "But I'm too scared because I know they'll just call my stake president, then I'll get in trouble." Pardon me? Of course. Now, let me just mention, last Sunday I gave a copy of the paper that you just heard. I handed this to my stake president and his wife. I never give him anything I don't address to his wife also. And I said, "I want you to have this paper. I'm giving it next Saturday at Sunstone." I did not ask for his permission. I said, "I want you to have this so that if you are questioned about it, you will know what it is that I have said." I occasionally also do write a letter. I don't bombard Salt Lake City with all of my frustrations. I occasionally write a very intelligent letter, which I did, in fact, just a week ago. I sent a copy of this talk, and I'll probably send a copy of that letter to some of the brethren, but I addressed this to the Relief Society Presidency, whom I wanted to have a copy of this talk, as well as the very good talk I gave in April at the Counterpoint Conference. But in this letter, I mentioned to them what I was observing in the current Relief Society lessons. I had, for 2 weeks, just in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I had sat there looking at the lessons with my pen, trying to see what really is being said to and about women. And in the Worldwide Pioneers lesson, there were about 17 male names mentioned, four nameless women referred to, and a very strange story that focused on a man, just barely bringing his wife in, even unannounced. And then, of course, after that lesson, we sang Faith of Our Fathers. And then the week after that, in a lesson on preparing for the temple, the same sort of thing that I just said to you about the male names and the Sister Jack's name was mentioned in that lesson. But there was something in that lesson, too, that I found really shocking. There was a statement quoting Brother Hinckley, talking about the importance of the temple, saying that such and such and such was the important reasons for attending, that it's the place where a man can come close to his divine parent and his redeemer. Now, in all of my years in the church, I have never heard the phrase divine parent. I never have. I've occasionally heard the phrase divine parents. And I can only accept this as a very deliberate attempt to emphasize the singularity of the father and to further erase the mother. I was willing to write a letter calling attention to my General Relief Society Presidency to that fact. I expect to send that letter on to some of the brethren. I am willing to risk a great deal in order to make this world better. And I can do it, first of all, in my own corner of the vineyard. And I will not sit down and be quiet.
The temptation's too great. I want to remind you that Gordon B. Hinckley also said on one occasion, "The idea of Mother in Heaven fits very well with me." Okay. Second interpretation possibility for this appropriately offending reference. A reference to a parent could well indicate the rising of consciousness in one's self that parentage exists, and we know in our heart, if we talk about parent, that there are two, and there is an optimistic way to read that reference, which I choose because it contributes to dialogue.
And may it so be.
Carol Ann, I stand reproved. You were perfect. You're wonderful. And I'm totally convinced. My response is more a revelation about where I am and my thinking. But I recognize your great contributions in so many ways. The title was what threw me. Could Feminism Have Saved the Nephites? It's based on the assumption that the Book of Mormon is true and the most perfect book. And that's what threw me. So my question is, if it is true and the most perfect book, and if we believe in a continuous revelation, then perhaps the brethren should reveal the rest of the 99% of the Book of Mormon, which was not revealed, right?
Joseph Smith said the Book of Mormon was the most correct and perfect, not the most politically correct. I have a technical question. Maybe you know this since you've talked with Hugh Nibley. When you spoke of Jesus and quoting him in the New Testament and in the Book of Mormon, Jesus didn't speak English. He spoke Aramaic. Did Aramaic have any gender references like English has?
Oh, my goodness. Do you expect that I should know that? No, I know nothing about that. I've been interested in a recent book. What's it called? He's saying, yes, so there are male-female pronouns in the Aramaic, but it would be difficult always to determine those. Let me just mention, there is a recent book, and what is it called, in which a Catholic scholar, I believe, went back to the original Aramaic to do some very, I'm sure, loose new translations of Jesus' words, and the Lord's Prayer, for example, that comes out, our divine Father and Mother of the universe.
So oftentimes when we hear statements, you know, like, the two women in a field or the two men in the field is not necessarily the words of Jesus, but the words of a translator.
Okay. Of course.
I'd like to thank you very much for your presentation and the research that went into this to find all the details about femaleness and gender that you went into. This is something I've thought of for about the last 4 years, and I've jokingly thought I would create a book of Mildred with book of Janine and Carol and First and Second Kathy, and then tell the men will have two references, the fathers mowed the lawns, and the men did exceeding work. And now you're to take this book and believe it. Read it and believe it. And it will contain all female issues. But the one comment that struck me is the very last comment of your talk where you said, we'll elevate women to divine mother. Even saying you have to elevate women to motherhood seems like you have to continue to sanitize and justify them. Women, there are women who deserve to be elevated without motherhood. And really the basic relationship is the man and woman. And the children are incidental to this. So she should be elevated to divine beloved or divine lover and not necessarily mother.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment briefly on the issue of gender and pronouns in the scriptures. We really don't have Jesus' words in Aramaic. What the scriptures have come down to us in is in Greek. And I'm not an expert in Greek, but I've had a semester of New Testament Greek. And in Greek, there certainly is a word for woman and for man. So if you have two women at the mill and one is taken, that's clearly a reference to women. That's not generic. Where it gets more complicated is where you have a plural pronoun
it's kind of like many of you are probably more familiar with Spanish, where you have hermanos could mean brothers and sisters, or it could just mean brothers. But in Greek, for example, there's a word for woman, there's a word for man, and there's a word anthropos, which could be translated men, but it's really the generic term for human beings. And so it's not really impossible to figure out that there were at least sometimes when Jesus was speaking with non-sexist language, provided that the Aramaic is translated into the Greek correctly. But if we look at the Greek, we can certainly weed out some of those things.
Thank you. Before I forget, those of you who didn't go to Lynn Anderson's presentation, you might want to get that tape. She had a very good presentation that would add to this one to make a very strong case about this whole thing.
I'd like to say I was extraordinarily delighted with your whole presentation. Thank you very much. On this idea of genders, I've been thinking, I used to take it as, like in German, church is die Kirche, it's feminine, and therefore when you talk about the abominable church, you have to say she. But I've been, so I just thought it was linguistics. But I have, and it's a bit more pessimistic, I've been recently thinking, ooh, wait a minute, there's something back in our brains. Why are we denoting certain things female and male? There's something more deeply rooted within us that makes us want to make these things, these gender specifications. And this thought, unfortunately, has made me a lot more pessimistic than I kind of am. I think that what we're trying to fight is bigotry that might be wired in us.
For at least 5,000 years, but there is hope because it has not always been there.
Well, that's, I want to hope for that too. And so I guess I'm just saying this battle looks a lot bigger to me now than it did an hour ago.
It is the mother of all battles.
And I must say that I always tell my friends, don't tell me about the mother of all battles. That's such an offensive thing to do, but perhaps you're right in this.
This comment is a little bit delayed, but I just wanted to respond to the comment that you threw out to the audience about what we can do. And I think sometimes in our discussions of feminism, we talk about it in a very isolated context, feminism within the church. And I think that it's really important to consider as a community of saints or intellectuals or feminists that the feminist agenda is remarkably broad beyond, you know, just the organization of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and that perhaps an effective strategy would to be able to take into consideration some of the things that are going on outside of just the specifically LDS community, and that a way to change, I mean, if we think that patriarchy is just functioning within the church, we're woefully mistaken. I mean,
of course,
it's bad every place, and that rather than just